my privilege to introduce our workshop leaders. We have two leaders today. Please help me offer a warm Tulare County welcome for our first workshop leader, Teddy B. Hycilia.
Thank you.
And also I'd like to introduce Linda V. of Ripon. She's going to be our second student. Okay.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Teddy Blackman, recovered alcoholic.
Hi, Teddy.
It's good to be here. So, you know, me and Stephanie stepped out before we started this, and this is the way, this is the only preparatory for doing this type of thing, is to go out and, you know, bow your head and say a prayer, you know what I mean? And let whatever comes out of my mouth come out of my mouth, hopefully it's, you know, comes out in the right way. I'd like to welcome anybody that's new to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to welcome to anybody that's new to the 12-step process, you know, because my first few years around Alcoholics Anonymous, that was, you know, one thing that wasn't really being discussed a whole lot was the actual process. And today, you know, I'm going to be talking about the nuts and bolts of this process and my experience doing it. And you know, I want to thank Linda for driving all the way down here to come and do the second half. I haven't, you know, I don't know Linda that well, other than a few conversations on the phone, but I'm looking forward to hearing her in the second half, and I want to thank her for driving this way to come and share her experience with us. And I just want to take a second real quick to thank Bill back there for, you know, over the years since I've been around Alcoholics Anonymous, he's been a consistent person that's been actively in service in this fellowship. And, you know, I just want to thank you, Bill, for all that you do. And
right on.
Yep. And, you know, let's give Bill a round of
applause.
And I say that because this stuff isn't easy to do. It takes a lot of organizing, a lot of time, and a lot of commitment. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes into doing this. So I really appreciate that, you know, and keeping the doors open for people that are new or have been around for a while and still have yet come to an actual solution to the problem of alcoholism, you know. And, you know, 6 months ago, you know, Bill invited me to come and we talked on the first step. Me and Stephanie did the first step, and, you know, we got invited back. You know, 6.5 years ago, I wasn't getting invited back anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my social calendar was very empty.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And, you know, not too many people, you know, so the idea that somebody's actually going to be inviting me back places is a very good thing. And I thank you, the group, for doing that. You know, Stephanie's going to be interacting with me too, you know. We share the same bank account, we share the same bedroom, we share a lot of things, and we share our spiritual life together too. And, you know, that's the most important thing to us, and everything else stems from that. So, today we're going to be talking about step four from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I wasn't always into this book, and this, as a matter of fact, the way that all this came about, how I got introduced to this process, was actually the real first introduction is Bill used to walk around the fellowship with CDs. And I just happened onto this CD of a guy named Chris Hammer from Texas. Bill gave me that freaking CD, and this dude's like an AA rebel, you know what I mean? And I was attracted to that. I was still very new, had a lot of defects, and, you know, and I liked it. But he was also talking about the solution from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was also talking about a condition that I was very much suffering from at the time, which was in a sober condition. And it has to do with the second half of step one, which is called untreated alcoholism. And I was sitting in the grips of a mass psychosis and didn't even know what I was suffering from. You know, and it just so happened that shortly after that, a guy came into the rooms from out of town sharing the exact message that, you know, a similar message that I was hearing on the CD. And right away I was gravitated toward him and said, man, I knew he was going to be the man that was going to be helping me because I wasn't taking no for an answer. You know, I was just desperate enough to do what he was trying. And we sat down and we started breaking down this book, and you know, he opened up this program in a way that I'd never seen. And one thing that he told me about the program that the founders had laid out for us in the preface of this book, it talks about, you know, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Precisely. Meaning we're going to show you how to take a step, when to take a step, with whom to take a step, and what it's going to be like after you take that step. We're going to break it down for you. You know, I'm not going to say, well, you know, this is, you know, Bobby Joe says this and Billy Joe says this. No, we're going to just follow directions. You know, I'm too stupid to come up with my own program to stay sober for 7 years almost now. Okay? So I'll just stay stupid and follow the directions that's worked for thousands and thousands of people. You know, and my experience of doing that has been life-changing. So, you know, we're going to start over in the chapter of how it works. You know, a lot of times you might hear in the program that, you know, I don't know how this program works, it just works. Well, we got a whole chapter here in chapter 5 called How It Works. And, you know, the whole theme of this chapter, you know, it kind of sets up what we're going to be talking about, this inventory process, because the whole theme of the chapter is kind of like, you know, what Bill talks about, where he's talking about each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, right? Okay, and that's kind of what my life looked like when I'm self-will, you know? And it goes on to say, he is forever trying to arrange the life, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. And I really got to see that, you know, in the first 3 steps, you know, and how I set up the stage out here, you know. I want to arrange the thing. You know, it talks about we're like the actor who wants to be the director, who ends up being the producer of confusion rather than harmony, right? And that's how I pretty much was. I was the actor trying to be the director, you know, but from an agnostic perspective, from a self-reliance perspective, I couldn't operate any other way but that, from that place. So, before we get over to the bottom of page 63, where step 4 actually begins, I want to go to a paragraph that's important to know, because this is actually going to get validated all the way through the inventory process. And it's at page 62, and it's in that first indented paragraph where it says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problems, right? And this is going to get validated in the third column of the inventory process, and we're going to get into that, okay? Selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of my problems, but that root is driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, right? Okay, roots have seeds, and I like to call these the seeds of self-reliance. Okay, and you know what it's like to be driven, right? I mean, if you're in the back of a cop car, anybody ever been in the back of a cop car? Right? You know what that's like? You're handcuffed, and it's driving you, and it's taking you wherever it wants to go, right? And that's kind of the way it was, whether I was drinking or not drinking, okay? I was being driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And this will all come to life. Now, what I'm going to be breaking down for you is, it's going to be a little technical, okay? But the hope that I want to leave you with is that there's more to do here than maybe what you had experienced, you know? Anything new to me always pisses me off in the beginning. But the things that have pissed me off in the beginning have always been the things that have set me free. And the question you got to ask yourself is, how free do you want to be? You know? I want to defend my belief systems. I want to defend what I think I know. I want to defend what I think is good. Right? There's so much for an open mind. Right? I could be in a place of dying from what I'm defending. Right? And still being so, you know, unwilling to freaking be open to any new ideas. Right? What do we call that? Consent prior investigation? I want to judge something before I actually try it. You know? Another character defect, right? But if you go down to the bottom of the paragraph, this is what's got to get validated in this inventory, where it says or the very next paragraph, so it says, so our troubles we think are basically of our own making. That has to be proven in the inventory process. Because if that doesn't get proven, if my troubles are not my own making, that means you guys have to come back and make amends to me. Right? And that might never happen. You know? There's people that are in the grave that I was convinced that it was their fault that my life was the way it was. Right? Now, if that didn't get proven for me, I could never get free. So, this has got to come to life for me. Okay? Very important. You know? But remember, roots have the fertile soil that they thrive in. And the fertile soil that they were thriving in, my selfish and self-centered roots, were the fertile soil of self-reliance. Okay? From a self-reliant place, I couldn't behave or operate any different. Okay? And that's pretty much the way that I lived my whole life. You know, so going down to the bottom of page 63, where we start the fourth step. Okay? And it says, down there, it says, next we launched out on a course of vigorous action, right? Notice those words that they're starting to use right there, right? Launched, vigorous, action, right? You ever seen a space shuttle take off? You know what that looks like? Right? Vigorous, action. See, I got to be clear on the difference of what action is and what activity is. I did two other inventories prior to coming to this, how I was shown how to write out of the big book. And I'm glad that I did, because it wasn't the instructions out of this book. And the thing that I want to share about that was, you know, it felt good to finish those things that I was doing, but it was just busy work activity. And the first inventory that I wrote was an autobiographical inventory, which was great. You know, I just kind of elaborated on what I already knew about myself. It didn't really bring me into any real truth to really, you know, show me anything new. And then the next time I did it around, I actually used the Hazelton Guide with the 12x12 and the big book and the guide. You know, I did all three of those things. And what we did, when we got over to, you know, the third column of the inventory process, is what we were doing is just checking off boxes, you know. And that was great too. It felt good to finish that. But it didn't produce the change that happened after I was taken through, you know, under my current sponsorship, you know. And you know, I just want to throw out there real quick, and I don't say this to brag, I say this because, you know, I want you to know that the message that I'm giving you has actually got a strong message of purity to it. You know, my sponsor is Dan S. from Santa Monica, California. His sponsor was Joe Hawk. Okay, Joe Hawk's sponsor was Don Pritz. Don Pritz's sponsor was Paul Martin. Okay, Paul Martin's sponsor was the first sober member in Chicago, which is Paul Stanley. Paul Stanley's sponsor was Dr. Bob. And of course, Dr. Bob's sponsor was Bill Wilson. So that's a very tight lineage. And the message that has been handed down from that man has a message of purity, where we're not into watering down the message. You're going to get it pure, or, you know, you're going to go somewhere else looking for help. That's kind of like how it was. And it was really effective for me, because of what it did for me. It produced a deep-seated change in me, you know. So, and, you know, I'm glad I got to do those other inventories, because I had something to compare, you know. And if you haven't heard this before, that's okay. Just stay open to it. A lot of the information might sound new. I get that a lot. You know, they think I'm speaking Chinese or something, you know. And it's like you go into my home group and they say, oh, you're part of that group over there, you know. It's like we're doing something new. And if all we're trying to do is get to deeper levels of what the book's actually saying. So, you know, just be open to it, you know. You know, you never know. You know, don't judge until you experience it, you know. It's like, you know, I used to have a lot of weird ideas around alcohol until I drank it, right? I was like, wow, now I know what they're all, you know, throwing away their life over, you know? This is worth it, until it was killing me. Do you want to say anything?
My name's Stephanie Earlbeck. My sobriety date is May 23rd, 1994. And I just want to start by saying before Teddy launches into explaining the fourth step, that I too had experience in doing what I thought was a fourth column inventory way back when, back in 94. And I was guided by some people. And, you know, in doing that inventory, the ending column in that inventory was actually called My Part. And so for me, what that really meant is that everyone else who I felt had done, you know, who was on that inventory list actually had a part too. You know, and we're going to look at the instructions later that say we leave the other person out entirely. But just like Teddy's experience, that experience of doing the fourth step did not remove the blocks to a higher power, which is really what this step is about. And what ended up happening for me in sobriety is that the longer that I stuck around the rooms, the more insane and sick I became. And so by the time I came to this group in Visalia, which to me is really, you know, amazing that I found this group in Visalia, California, the Central Valley, after living down in Southern California and then over in Massachusetts, which are big, huge cities, I was launched into this course. One of the things I want to say is that all the years that I spent in Alcoholics Anonymous, I never really got the true meaning of my first step. I just didn't. I had never really conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. I knew it because I kept coming to AA and I was doing the things. I was convinced I had a problem, but not deep down within. And no one really ever showed me how to go through that first step. That first step is many, many pages, more pages than any other step in this book. And there's a lot of instructions and ways that we're supposed to look at it and considerations that we're supposed to do. And if it wasn't for me going through those first three crucial steps, 1, 2, and 3, there's no way that I could ever get to a truth in 4, right? So if I come into this fourth step, like let's say I just walked into this workshop today, and Teddy had this paper and he was, you know, going through the instructions and everything, and I'm just like, oh cool, I'm going to do this, right? I guarantee you that my experience with 4 would have been convoluted and confusing, and I wouldn't have known what I was doing. So the little disclaimer that I want to share is that if you decide that maybe this is something that, you know, you want to do the instructions right out of the book the way that we're doing them, I would suggest that you get with somebody who actually has experience in going through the first portion of the book. It's extremely important. Just in my experience, that's my truth, you know? So I wanted to say that. And my life today in Alcoholics Anonymous is nothing like it was before, you know? Nothing like it was. And it's totally because of going through this work, I've been able to, like it says at the end, swallow some big, huge chunks of truth about myself and go out there and really try to amend that behavior. Be open to new ideas and not just parrot what I hear about, you know, around the room. And the most crucial thing is that, you know, I have a dependence upon God today. That dependence, like this book is set up to get me dependent on a higher power, the power that's keeping me sober, not on a sponsor, not on the group, not on a boyfriend, not on money, not on a job, not on any of that. Not on the years I have, none of that. Because my teachers actually had much less time than I did coming into this process. And they had so much more of what I wanted. I was lacking. They had 2 and 3 years. I had 15. They had a God that was working in them and shining through them. I was sick and dying. So that's really all I wanted to share real quickly about my experience. And I hope all of you, you know, stay open-minded. I think it would be a good idea for us to probably say the set-aside prayer real quick before we start and then go on. Or okay. So I'm going to say the set-aside prayer several places throughout the book. If you have questions, you can ask Teddy where it is in the book after. He's good with all that real remembering and stuff. I'm not so great. So if you could repeat after me, God, please help me set aside.
Please help me set aside
everything I think I know,
everything I think I know
about you,
about
this book, the 12 steps, and everything I've heard in meetings, so that I may be granted with an open mind
and
a new experience
with you
and all these things.
Please
help me to see the truth.
All right. So, that was great. So, like we said, we were talking about next, we launch on a course of vigorous action, right? And that's, I'm not going to go launch it unless, like she talked about, unless I have a solid foundation established in those first three steps. And that's me too, you know. There are three requirements before, I mean, there's three steps that I have to get in this before I'm going to go launch it into an inventory. You know, most people think that, oh, if all I got to do is see my powerlessness in step one, that, you know, and that is true. You need to see your powerlessness. I mean, you know, the idea in step one is I'm going to come out of, you know, the experience of step one, not that I can't drink, but that I will drink, that there's nothing standing in between me taking the next drink, right? I've got to get that there is no human power, right, that could relieve me of my alcoholism, not the group, not the sponsor, not anybody, you know? And if I'm going around telling you that, what I'm really telling you is I'm not clear on my own truth of alcoholism, right? I sat in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and was drinking, okay? That's my experience, and it's a whole lot of other people's experience, too, you know? But not only that did I have to get that truth in step one, and that I couldn't manage my own life, but I had to really, going into step two, now everybody says, oh, this is all about God now. Well, not really. The title of the chapter isn't We Believers. It's called We Agnostics, right? And what I seen was, when I went through that chapter, I was asked to underline anywhere where I wasn't willing to believe or rely that there was a power that would work for me in my life. And that took me to a deeper level of seeing that me walking around living this agnostic lifestyle and seeing the results of that, it took me into this deeper level of going, oh, okay. Now I've seen my powerlessness in step one, and then I see my agnosticism in step two, and then I started looking at my life run on self-will in step three, failing me. That's the first requirement, that we be convinced that any life run on self-will could hardly be a success. So what I seen was, is it took me each step along the way, chipped away at this idea that self-reliance was going to work for me, right? It chipped away at this part of me that thought I could do the trick myself. And then getting into step four was going to be a blueprint of what my life looked like around self-will, right? It's going to give me a script. Each page, like, right, if I'm a director, I'm writing the script. Each page of my inventory process was me writing the script, right? And I got to see how I wrote you a script, wrote me a script, wrote everybody in my life scripts, right? And then I wondered why I was, you know, bogged down with resentment and everything else. Because I lived my life writing scripts. And it was like, you know, I couldn't understand why you didn't get the script. You know? I want to keep moving, though. It says the the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in me that were blocking us, right? It could have, they're talking about my third step decision, okay? Many people think that the third step is turning my will and my life over to God, right? Remember, step three is just a decision, okay? You have three frogs sitting on a log and two decide to jump off. How many are left? You still got three frogs sitting on that log. They just decided, okay? That implies action. And it's telling me that it will have little permanent effect. See, there's a difference between relief and release. You know, I could come in here and get a little bit of relief. You know, my ideas was get the girl back, get the job back, get my life looking good out here, right? And then I'm going to go on and graduate from AA, right? That was my idea at first coming in. You know, but this book talks about permanent effect. Okay? And how do I turn my will and my life over to God? You know, you hear a lot in meetings, you'll hear people say, I turn it over, take it back, turn it over, take it back. You know, if I'm clear in the first two steps, there's nothing to take back. You know? If I'm turning my will and my life over, how do I do that? That's the question that's banging around in my head. What does that look like? And steps 4 through 12 is the answer. You want to know how you follow through with that decision? When you're sitting down with a piece of paper writing inventory in step 4, right? Now I'm taking my inventory. It's no longer me taking yours. Those are actions contrary to the way that I've always lived my life. And that's what it means to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Now I'm going to go share this with another human being, things I swore I'd never admit to anybody. And then I'm going to take those exact nature of my defects of character in step six, right, and become willing to, you know, have God remove them in step seven. And then go out and make a list of all persons I've harmed in step eight. And then how do I know I'm, you know, willing in step eight? When I hear that real funny noise like a knocking on somebody else's door in step nine. If I'm still sitting at the car and I'm not up at the door, I'm still in step eight. Right? Now, when I first came into the rooms and I'd look up on the wall, I'd look at those steps and I'd go, yeah, those are all doable. And then you get over to the amends process, you know, it's like, I don't know about that, you know, because I had a whole litany of amends that I needed to make. And I wasn't willing to do it. But thank God the truth about step one was big enough to move me. And the person that you are at step one isn't going to be the same person you're going to be at step eight. Guarantee you that. You know? And it says, this is why we write inventory, to face and to be rid of the things that are blocking us off from myself, from God, and from others. That's why we write inventory. That word rid of is synonymous with the word remove in step six. Okay? This isn't about me coping, dealing with, this isn't self-help. You know, if you think you're going to write a bunch of stuff down and work on yourself, that is not a spiritual action that you're taking. Okay? You're actually implying that you could help yourself. You, obviously, you know, what needed to be experienced in step one, which that there's nothing that I could do to fix me. There's nothing to do that I can that can keep me sober nor manage my own life. And if I'm clear on that truth, you know, what do I think I'm going to be working on over here in step four? You know? So this is about facing and being rid of the things that are blocking me off from others and God and myself. Okay? It goes on to say, our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. Now, the liquor was just a symptom of the spiritual malady that set up that condition conducive for the obsession to return that took me back to the first drink, that set off that physical allergy, and then the result of how my life was trashed behind that. Okay? It's going to take you deeper down inside. The book is, you know, our liquor is but a symptom, right? Liquor is what you see on the outside. The causes and conditions are what's going on the inside. I needed to get down to those things, right? Mm-hmm. You could be suffering from alcoholism whether you're at a full glass of the bottle or an empty glass. I don't need to have booze in my body to be suffering. Okay? And it's only a matter of time if that condition doesn't get treated. You know, it's going to set up that mental obsession for me to take the first drink. You know? It says, therefore, we started up on a personal inventory. This is step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock and trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsellable goods to get rid of them. There's that word of good. Get rid of. Not work on. Not deal with. Not cope with. Okay? To get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he couldn't fool himself about values. Okay? I can't fool myself about the value of holding on to a ring. You know, I like that analogy that some people say, and you know, they say, it's like me drinking poison and expecting you to die. Right? I can't fool myself about the values of that thing. And what kind of business am I in? When I've entered into this process, this is the business of spiritual living. Okay? I can't fool myself about the values of the things that are going to spiritually separate me from that power. Right? If I'm powerless, right, when I'm separated spiritually, I need to be hooked up to the power. And trust me, if any of you know, you guys want anything that will separate you quicker than anything else, tie on a good resentment. You know what I mean? That puts me right off into self. Okay? But, you know, it's like I got this closet at home full of clothes. Right? You know, and she actually was saying stuff to me because everything's bunched in this closet, right? I mean, there's clothes piled in there. Me and her share a closet. And I'm thinking, she's like, you need to get rid of some of that stuff that's in your closet. You know, because it's getting in the way of everything. There's no room in that. My idea is that, you know, there's some, I'm going to eventually wear some of this stuff, right? I'm going to use it. I got this idea that there's still value in holding on to some of this stuff until it started to get in my way, too. And then it was like, you know, I'm showing up late to places because I can't find the clothes that I want to wear. You know, and it's getting in my way. And it's, you know, but I think there's value in hanging on to this stuff that I've never, you know, and then my first solution was like, we need a bigger closet, you know. But, you know, that's not that big of a deal, you know, your closet at home. But to be carrying around this stuff inside of your head is a different story. I can't fool myself about the value of the stuff that I leave up there in my head, right? And that's basically the way that I've been walking around my whole life, carrying around this closet full of garbage in my head, you know, and not being able to get free of that, you know? So I can't fool myself about the values of the my life. You know what I'm saying? Okay, so going down to the bottom paragraph, you know, before that it says, being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us. Not alcohol, but self. Mm-hmm. Right? Those are the things that are defeating me. And how the common manifestations of self in this book are resentment, fear, dishonesty, self-seeking, you know, my conduct in relationships with other people, you know. All those things were how self had manifested itself. And the first thing that we go and start looking at is resentment, okay? So they say at that bottom paragraph, resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else, even more than alcohol. It's the number one offender. They're telling you resentment destroys more people than anything else, right? It says, from it stem all forms of spiritual disease. For we have been not only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. You know, my thing is I used to think, you know, these are just stuff that would come into my head and then I just start feeling them in my body. But here they're telling me something else. They're telling me that, just like with my drinking, that there's a condition that's not only in my mind and my body, but that they define this as a spiritual disease. Okay? And what I got to get here, see, in the first half of step one, they tell me that the main problem centers in the mind. But that's in the first half of step one. We got another whole half of step one that we got to talk about, right? And this is what they're talking about here, is the spiritual malady, okay? The spiritual disease. Everything else stems from that. It says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Now that's both a promise and a warning. A promise and a warning. Because if the spiritual malady is overcome, then I will straighten out mentally and physically. But they're warning me here that if it's not overcome, then that's going to set up the condition conducive to take the first drink, return me back to set off that physical reaction in my body where I can't control stopping after I start, and then the result of the consequence of that comes. Am I willing to gamble with that? I got to ask myself, how clear am I on the first half of step one? Because if that's what's going to lead me back to drinking, I don't know what kind of beating you took from alcohol. I don't know what kind of ass kicking you got, but I know what kind of ass kicking I got. And I'm not willing to let anything take me back to the first drink. You know, but the thing is I can't do anything about that. But they're telling me here that needs to be treated spiritually. Okay? It says, we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. So now we're going to get into the instructions part of the fourth step, right? Mm-hmm. This is where I start. In the people that I work with, I send them home to go and make a list of the people, the institutions, and the principles, right? You know, and I turn that little statement in the first paragraph that we read. God, help me face and be rid of the things that are blocking me off from you, myself, and from others. I have them write that at the top of the page and say that prayer before they even start writing. You know, this is an exercise in inviting something in, even though you're not maybe not familiar with it at this point because you're blocked off from it. But the more you do these spiritual exercises, you're gonna be amazed at what comes off your pen and onto the paper. At least that was my experience. And I have to go home and I start making a list of the names, right? We know who the people are, right? Then the institutions like the IRS, the jails, right? You know, whoever it may be, the churches, whoever may come off, whatever institution, the schools, right?
EDD.
Yeah, exactly. EDD, right? And then with the principles, you know, principles are the deep-seated ideas that govern my life, okay, that I'm living by. For example, if I come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and they say, don't date any newcomers in the first year, and that's the common theme going around the room, that might piss me off. I might be resentful at that idea if I want to date a newcomer in their first year. Right? You see what I'm saying? Or if you came like a religious background like I came from, I grew up in a Pentecostal church, which was, if you thought it, you've already sinned. Now that pissed me off because I could never live up to that. Right? Right? And I had all this stuff carrying around in my head, these deep-seated beliefs. Or like, you know, the man is the breadwinner of the home. Why does that piss me off? Well, she makes more than I do, so she's the breadwinner in the home, you know? I had all these different principles that were guiding my life, you know? And there's a bunch of them, you know? If they tell me, you know, maybe the principle of don't drink, you just go to meetings. Well, why does that make me angry? Because I'm going to meetings and I'm still drinking. You know, I can't make that happen. That doesn't work for me, right? So I inventory all these principles. I put the principles in the first column. After they come back and the list is done, then we move on to the cause, okay? Which is the second column. Now I know it doesn't say columns in the book, but that's, you know, what everybody's pretty much familiar with that does this. So that's the word that I use. And the cause is, you know, why am I angry at these people? You know, that's the next instruction. And that doesn't mean that you go home and you write a big long narrative about why you're angry, okay? There's actually a pretty good example on the next page where it says, we were usually as definite as this example, where it says, Mr. Brown, Mr. Jones, the employer, the wife. They give little bullet points, you know, because anything after that is really what I'm trying to do is just justify why I'm angry, you know? So that's all I need, his attention to my wife. That's pretty clear cut, right? I don't need to go on beyond that, okay? So anything beyond that, and I'm just justifying my right to be angry at you, you know? So I just keep it short and sweet. And I try to be realistic here, and I try to not get too repetitive, you know? If I say he kicked me, he punched me, you know? He slapped me. Or, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm basically saying the same thing. I can consolidate all those into one thing, right? Those are all encompassing right there, and I could just say, you know, he abused me, or whatever, right? And that'll sum it up, like, that quick, okay? So they go back, and I've had this experience where I've worked with these guys that have, you know, they try to tell me if they're not mad at anybody. And they're usually the real self-driven type guys, you know? And I say, okay, maybe you're not resentful of anybody, but just write people down that bother you. and guess what? Now their list looks like everybody else's. So, and I think that's more, to me, I think it's a guy thing, it's like a macho thing. I don't want to admit that I'm really angry at anybody or doing anything like that. But, you know, it's the purpose of doing the inventory is to get down to how it's hurt, threatened, angered, or interfered with, like it talks about over here. You know, now we're going to be getting into the affect my part, which is the third column. Okay? Now this is where it gets tricky. Okay? Even explaining all this can be really confusing, and it might just, it can almost seem like a math class where you're going, You know what I mean? But the way that I was taught to write, I know that in the effects of my column over here, they just have little things right here, and it says we are a definite example. But if you go down to the bottom of the page, it says when we went back through our lives, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. We considered the third column carefully. So, you know, like I said, I'd done the checkbox inventory before, but that wasn't really considering it carefully. To me, it was like if you asked me how my self-esteem was affected, I couldn't really tell you. And by the time I got into the fifth step, you know, because the reason of writing this down is I'm going to go fifth step it with somebody. So by the time I got over to the fifth step, it was like I forgot how my self-esteem was affected, you know? So when I was taught to do the third column from this pack and what we call an extended third column from way back in our sponsorship line, that these guys were doing this. And it was passed down. And it works beautifully. And it's like you introduce this and people are going, whoa, you know? And then they got a huge first column. See? And they love the fact that they're like, yeah, I'm writing all these people down that I'm angry at. Now we're talking. And then they get over to the next part and they see what's coming after that. And then you should see the look on their face when they see what's coming down the pipe. Some of you have done it, so you know what we're talking about. You know, my first time doing this, I ended up with 1,000 pages of inventory.
Wow.
You know, and trust me, you don't have to do that. I wasn't being really realistic. I was trying to be overly thorough, you know? And that's what I try to get down to is the people that I work with, I want to be realistic. Is this really something that you're mad about? Or is it just, you know, are you just thinking you're mad, you know? What is a resentment? Something that I refeel over and over and over, you know? It isn't something like, oh, well, you know, he didn't pay attention to me one time, so, you know, it's like, that was 20 years ago. You know, whatever comes off your pen, write it down, and we'll talk about it. You know, and I'm not going to try to edit your list for you, but I am going to ask you to be realistic, you know. So going back to the third column. Now, these are my selfish and self-centered false notions that we look at in the third column, okay? And these are basically like, you know, I like to look at it from the theme of me being out in the audience with the director with a little sign on the back that says director, right? Looking up at the stage and how I arrange the lights, the scenery, the ballet and the rest of the players like it talks about in the book. You know, this is the way that I'm arranging and suiting life to suit myself. Okay? So, the first two things that we go off, there's seven areas of self that are pinned down here. The first one is self-esteem. The next one is pride. The next one would be ambitions, security, personal, sex relations, and pocketbooks. Okay? Now, if I'm the director and I'm looking up on the stage, you know, self-esteem is how I see or feel about myself. Okay? That's the role that I've assigned Teddy. Okay? Pride is how about the spectators, how I want others to see me. Okay? That's the role that I've assigned you. Okay? And then ambitions is what I wanted to happen here. Okay? This is what I wanted to snatch out of the scene. And the security is what I needed deep down inside to be okay. Okay? And personal relations is my deep-seated belief how this a relationship should look. And then sex relations has to do more with gender. How I think a real man should be in this play right here. And then the pocketbooks have to do with, you know, finances, how my pocketbooks were affected. Okay? So, I actually brought in some inventory. You want to get it? And some of my personal inventory that I've written, and it's kind of old. And it's going to kind of give us an example of what we're looking at here. Okay?
Can you go up to there and, point out what was the first column, what second and
third? Yes, exactly. So I'll go back through. This is a resentment that I have, okay? And I'll use a resentment that I think is pretty relevant. You know, this one's I'm resentful at. This is the first column. Ex-girlfriend, right? The cause left me when I needed her most, right? And see, what had happened was I was actually 3 years sober when she left me. You know, I came home one day and she told me, me and the kids are moving out and you're not coming along. You know, and what had happened was is I had lost my job, you know, and I decided I was going to go back to school. And, you know, and I was going to, I'll do little side jobs, you know, do my own little lawn business on the side, and that ought to be good enough to get by with. Well, you know, and I was always gone. I was always staying gone. I was going to meetings. I was always hanging out in recovery. I was never home. She never, it was like this, you know, she's passing me, I'm passing her type of thing, in and out the door, you know. And it was kind of like the same thing that I did when I was hanging out at the bar. You know, 'cause she was with me before I got sober, or I was hanging out at a friend's house, you know. So she left me when I needed her most was in the second column. And the self-esteem is how I see myself. And what I got here is, I'm the best boyfriend she can get. Right? Now, you might think that sounds arrogant, right? Right? But if I thought I was the worst boyfriend she could get, my name would be in column one and her name wouldn't be there. But because I thought I was the best boyfriend she could get, her name goes up there. And that conflicts with the second column. The best man she could get wouldn't get left. Right? You get that? Okay. But see, what I got to get here is it says, notice that the word fear was bracketed alongside, right? On page 67 where it gets into the fear. The difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and his wife, right? The fear that's bracketed alongside is driving this whole thing. And this is what it looks like when I'm living my life from a self-reliance perspective. Okay? When I'm living my life not knowing that there's something that I could turn to that could remove that fear from my life, this is how I react to the rest of the world. And this is the role that I've assigned Teddy, is I'm the best boyfriend she can get. Now, looking up at the stage and assigning her the next role was in my pride, right? And this is how I think she should see me, which is no one should think I'm not worth staying with, right? No one should think I'm not worth staying with. And the fear that's racking alongside that is very simple. I take the word worth, which would be the fear of being worthless. Okay?
Hey, Teddy.
Yeah.
If you would, can you elaborate on what you wrote in the parentheses for the fear of being?
Yeah, the fear.
You talked about it, but you didn't explain what you wrote.
Oh, yeah. I wrote the fear of not being a good enough boyfriend. I put NGE. Just for, like, abbreviation. Okay, sorry about that. Good. Thanks, Glenn. Yeah, but that's what the fear was driving, that whole idea, right? That's the difficulty that I'm having. I see myself as this, you know, the best boyfriend she could find, but now I got this fear that's driving me, which is that I'm not good enough, right? So from that place, you know, I couldn't react any different, you know? And then with no one should think that I'm not worth staying with, the word in that phrase is work. Right? So very simply, what would go over here is the fear of being worthless. Okay? Make sense? And then going down, we go to ambitions. Okay, ambitions is what I wanted to happen here. Right? This is what I wanted out here. Remember, ambitions is what happens out here. Security is what I need in here. Okay? But what I wanted to happen out here is I wanted to be loved and wanted no matter what I do. Who cares if I'm not looking for a job? Right? She should be okay with that.
Right.
I mean, I had a job 6 months ago. I'm still trying to milk that. Right? I wanted to be wanted and loved no matter what I do. And very simply, the fear that's attached to that is the fear of not being wanted and the fear of being unloved. Then we go down here to security. Right? Security is what I need in here to be okay, which is I need to not be abandoned to be okay. Okay? I need to not be abandoned to be okay. Or I could come up with, you know, others should see my value as a person, right? So the fear of I need not to be abandoned is the fear of being abandoned, right? Or the fear of being alone. And then down here is my deep-seated idea of how this personal relationship should look. Now, she was my fiance habit, right? So we're going to be getting married. My deep-seated idea of how this relationship should look is girlfriends never leave their boyfriends no matter what. Right? no matter what, no matter if I'm unemployed, no matter what's going on. She's supposed to have my back. She's supposed to support me 100%. And the fear that was attached to that was the fear of being alone. And this is how my deep-seated idea of how a real man interacts in this situation, right? Okay, my gender. And a real man commands the respect of his girlfriend, right? And the fear that I have there is the fear of not being respected, right? If she respected me, she would stay, right? And then I would know that I wouldn't be abandoned, right? And then out here, I'd be getting the love, and to feel wanted. And from that place, I assign her this role, right? Is no one should think that I'm not worth staying with. And from that place, I assign myself the role of, I'm the best she'll ever get. You know what I mean? You see how it works from backwards up. And when you start doing inventory from this perspective, this isn't something that you're going to listen to and get what I'm talking about. This comes from doing. And I promise you, if you do 5 or 6 of these, you'll never want to do it any other way. This has brought me so much freedom from doing this. It changed me. And see, those other inventories were great, and I felt like I finished something, but it didn't change me inside. This was something that actually I got in touch with the root of my trouble. Right? If you don't get down to the root of the problem, you're just scratching the surface. So that's how we break down the third column from a perspective. And when I fifth step it, I know exactly what I'm talking about. It's just not mumbo jumbo that I'm writing down and checking off. So we're getting deep. You want to say anything?
No. Well, I just want to say, probably before he goes on, I think that's a great example that he put on there. And, prior to coming into this inventory, like I said, I had done a fourth column inventory. And in that fourth column, when I was writing my part, the only thing I was really clear on is, I would write some stuff down like, I was maybe selfish or something, but I know for sure, like, it just didn't get me into ever looking at how I affected others, how my behavior affected others. And, I just want to say that after 15 years of being in AA, I was still convinced that I was a victim of circumstance, much like I felt out there, Why are the police arresting me? I'm not hurting anybody. I'm just over here in my house, doing my thing. What's up, right? And it was the same thing here, right? I don't deserve the way that my husband's treating me. Why are these people at work picking on me? And I never could see that inner stuff that I had been doing. I never was able to view my selfishness and self-centeredness as the problem. It was always everyone else's problem out here. I was convinced of that. And until I did this inventory, that did not change. That whole idea did not change. And what happened is that I hated everybody. So I would sit in AA meetings. I was doing everything I was supposed to do, showing up, suiting up, doing the cake, being very committed. I was always committed to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was sitting in a place of judgment. I was just sitting up here thinking, I can't stand this dude. Seriously, sharing that crap again? He is so full of it, right? And this was my attitude throughout life, not only in Alcoholics Anonymous, but at home, with friends. And I always say that, thank God, I thought as I continued on my path that people were going to come to me for help, right? Because, hey, I got a lot of time. And the truth of the matter is that no one asked me for any help, and I know why today, right? Because they could sense that illness and that judgment and that attitude inside me. So I couldn't effectively help anyone. They just wanted to keep me like at arm's distance. And today it's very different. Today, I can be used by that power and not walk around with that same attitude that I had. So doing it this way really left me with freedom. I'm going to talk more about the realization, because I had been married twice prior to doing this. Obviously, relationships were failing all the time. And one of the things I've been convinced about is that, I was extremely mistreated in those relationships. I never saw ever that I had done anything wrong. It was always the two of them, at different times, of course. but.
Anyway, good. So we got to. I'm going to try to gauge my time wisely here.
Yeah.
So it says we at the bottom of 66 it talks about we turned back to the lift for it held the key to the future, right? Mm-hmm. And it goes on to say we must master our resentments. And so the key to my future is to master my resentments. Mm-hmm. Okay? And the way that I did this was to do exactly what it talks about. It says at the bottom of that, this was our course. We realized the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. And I was taught a very simple exercise that was actually really eye-opening. You know, it was very simple, but it was very eye-opening. And it was like, I went back and I did exactly what it says. Though we did not like their symptoms at the top of 67 and the way they need to stir up, they, like ourselves, were sick too. Now the part that I needed to get was they like ourselves, you know? So is what happened is the things that I resented in column two, how have I done the same things to the person in column one and or others? Okay? The things that I find objectionable about you were usually the things that I found objectionable about myself. And in this interaction, I flip it around and now we're going to column four. And what we look at here is the realization was is I left her home while I was drinking. I would stay gone. I'd hang out at people's house. I'd call and say, I'll be home in a little bit. And sometimes I wouldn't come home at all. Right? So, and then when I sobered up in recovery, it was like I would go to the meeting after the meeting, the meeting before the meeting. I was hanging out with all my friends, staying out way too late, coming in, and it was just like the same old thing. The only thing that was different probably was that we had removed the substance. Okay? And it was like, what I seen there was is, I left her long before she left me. And that freaking changed me. I couldn't get to that truth on my own power. Okay? It took an inventory like this to shed light on this thing. Okay? And this is where I really started to get freed up. You know, thanks to good sponsorship that wasn't willing to endorse any of my behavior, he made it quite as clear. Okay? And in the fourth column, we start looking at these four things down here in this paragraph, where it's going to talk about where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened on page 67. And the way that I look at self-seeking and selfishness, those are the things that are you see out here. My self-seeking is self-seeking actions, the actions that I'm taking or not taking. Or the selfishness would be my selfish attitude. That's the attitude that I'm displaying with this whole thing, the thing that really gets people ticked off. Right? But then I had to go deeper down inside with the two things, the next two things, right? They talk about the character defects, but in the fifth step, it also talks about the nature of my character defects. See, anytime the book talks about nature, it's what's going on the inside. Selfishness and self-seeking is what you see on the outside. Nature of my defects of character and my dishonesty with my self-delusion and my fears. And those are the things that I was being driven by. Okay? Like it says, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, right? I can't work on my delusions, right? You can't work on a delusion. You don't even know, you believe it's true, right? I couldn't work on that. But it wasn't until I started looking at this from this perspective that I was able to see that. And what I see is that I had this fear manufacturing plant that was driving this whole thing. And it started from that place. See, resentment was a mask for fear. Fear was a mask for self-reliance. Okay? Remember, self-reliance is the motor that's driving this whole thing. And everything else stems from that. So what I got here in the self-seeking, and I'll show you how this goes. Self-seeking. My selfish actions were left her at home while I stayed out late drinking, only concerned with what I needed. I was in a committed relationship acting single. Right? Didn't try to get a job after being let go from my job. Right? My selfish attitude was, it's my life. I'm not hurting anyone. At least I'm sober now, right? She has no right to tell me how to live. Who does she think she is? She's only going to be my wife. Right? This is my expo for my I'll clarify that now. But what was driving all this and the dishonesty that I got is I was in the delusion that committed relationships don't last and they will always fail anyway. Okay? And the fear that was underneath that was driving this whole idea was I was afraid that I'm never going to be good enough to keep a relationship going and ultimately I will end up alone. That was what I was afraid of happening. And what I've seen was is after doing this, I could go all the way back to my childhood and my parents, they divorced at a very young age. I got an idea. My grandma and grandfather, they divorced. I always developed this idea that relationships don't work anyway, so that's the way that I approach the relationship from the perspective that it's not going to work out anyway. And then from that, I took all this selfish attitude and these self-seeking actions. So what I see here is that I have these deep-seated fears, right, that drive these self-delusions that result in my selfish thinking, my attitude, that ended up in those self-seeking actions that I took. And you see how that plays itself back, we go backwards. We start at the root and it works its way out. Once you get down to doing this, like I said earlier, you'll never want to write inventory any differently. You know, I've watched people get so free of people that they thought they could never get free of writing inventory this way. Where you will go from the perspective and see what happens is the second column turns into a lie. She didn't leave me when I needed her most. I left her long before she left me. That's the truth. Mm-hmm. That's what this inventory process connected the dots with. Okay? And then, you know, the harms I put at the end. I trashed the relationship. I robbed her of emotional and financial security. See, I like to say, I never stole anything, but I was an emotional thief. Right? She didn't know what I was doing. She was sitting at home all by herself, worried about where I was, what was going on. Right? I stole her peace of mind. I robbed her. I was an emotional thief. Financial insecurity. I wanted to live off the contributions that I made 6 months ago. Right? No one should disregard my financial contribution. They should be valued, even if they are old. Right? You know, that's the way that I was. And when I went back and made amends for this, you know, I got an earful. I got to hear it from her mouth, you know, and I got to hear her get free. And I'm still paying financial amends on this, by the way, every month. I'm making a payment based on this. But this is how we break down the resentment part of the inventory. Now, this is real technical when you're first hearing it. But I promise you, when you start doing it, you won't want to do it any other way. And yeah, I'm going to show you how I break down the fear real quick. Okay? So what's the fear? Give me a fear.
Not good enough. Okay, yeah, I'm not good enough.
So why do I have the fear of not being good enough? Because if I'm not good enough, then I have a fear of not being loved. Right? Because we ask ourselves why we have these fears. I'm going to get down to the root. Why do I have a fear of not being loved? Because if I'm not loved, then I'm going to be unwanted. Right?
Here, Teddy. Use this one.
Why do I have a fear of being unwanted? Because if I'm unwanted, then I'm going to end up all alone. Well, why do I have a fear of being alone? Because if I'm all alone, then I end up in emotional pain. That's an emotionally painful place to be, is all by myself, right? And if I sit in the emotional pain long enough, I'm going to end up drunk, right? Because I can't just sit there and be in emotional pain all by myself, all alone. So I have a fear of drinking again. Why do I have a fear of drinking? Because for me to drink is for me to die.
Yeah.
Why do I have a fear of dying? What happens then? What happens if I die? I don't know. I don't know what that's like. I don't know if that's going to be good. I don't know if that's going to be bad. I don't know if that's going to be nothing at all. The fear of the unknown. Right? Well, why do I have a fear of the unknown? Because maybe that little voice in the back of my head that tells me that there is no God on the other side to catch me, my agnostic belief system that I have, that there's not going to be anything on the other side of dying to catch me. Maybe right. So what do I have there? Fear of no God. Right? And what if there is no God? Who in the hell am I left with? I'm left with me, all by myself. And if you look on page 68, it validates exactly what the book says. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? And at the root of this fear is the fear of relying on self. That is my core fear. So you can see I got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 fears here underneath each layer that I'm being driven by. From a self-reliance perspective, this is what always happens. I'm in this place. You know? But it wasn't until I started relying on something else, and they give us an exercise to start practicing in the fear inventory, which is one of my favorite prayers. If you're not practicing this, and you're used to walking around in fear, I promise you, start practicing this fear, which is, God, remove my fear and direct my attention to who you'd have me be. And keep practicing that, and you'll see what happens. The promise is we commence to outgrow fear at once. And that doesn't say that I'm not going to experience fear, but what the book does say is that I'm going to get courage. Right? It's like before I got here, I had the fear of probably not being good enough. What did I do? I prayed out and everything was just like, it was like nobody's business. I can come up here and do this flawlessly. Right? I couldn't do that on my own power. You know? But this is what we do. Now, if you're saying you're being driven by 100 forms of fear, our big book defines fear as being an evil and corroding thread. And if I'm being driven by 100 forms of evil, that is not a good thing for me to know. Right? Right? Okay? Because fear is an evil and corroding thread. That's not an emotion. That's a spiritual condition. Okay? That's what how the spirituality drives me. Now, if you take these fears, if I had 30 resentments and I got 7 areas of self, you take 30 times 7, that's 210 fears. And some of them are going to be duplicates. Right? And it really, what it breaks down to is exactly what the book says, which is 100 forms of fear. So, this is a lot to take in, but once you start writing inventory like this, you're going to see what I'm talking about. And you're going to see that fear is driving all this stuff. You know, when you cross my path and I get pissed off, it's not because you did that to me. It's because I'm already afraid. You just brought it up out of me. Right? And if it would have been you, it would have been some other jerk. Right? Right? But when you get to this place, right, and this is the first thing, like when in the fifth step where it says we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. When I started experiencing my fears fall from me, and I started to forgive the people in my resentment inventory, it was no longer just some theoretical, theological idea that I had about some higher power. I was actually experiencing it. When God forgave me, when I started to forgive other people, I knew that God had forgiven me without a shadow of a doubt. You know? And that's where this inventory process has brought me to. You know? And then I thank God from the bottom of my heart that I know Him best. He isn't the God that I grew up learning about. That's not my experience. He actually saved my life on October 6th, 2007, separated me from the alcohol. I ended up in the room, got connected to this process. I got a pretty cool relationship with this God. If He can keep me sober, what else can He do? Right? Wouldn't you want to get to know the thing that saved your life? Makes sense, don't it? I found out there's all kinds of other stuff to get. And then, you know, you go into the sex inventory where it says many of us need an overhauling there. You know the difference between you ever break down an engine? You know the difference between an overhauling and a tune-up? Right? So, holding those. You know, you're going to completely strip the whole thing down and put different parts, new parts, right? And this is a lot of the people that I work with, this is the problem area that there's a lot of struggling going on. It's in this area. The conduct in relationships. Not whether I should be in the relationship or be out of the relationship, but how am I behaving in that relationship? You know? What does my conduct look like? You know? I mean, my picker was broken. I've seen all through my sex inventory. I kept picking the same girl over and over and over and then wondering why I was always pissed off at him. You know? But I've seen that I was very selfish. The way I was going about getting in these relationships was based on selfish and self-seeking motives. And the reasons why I would stay in these relationships, because of the hooks. The shelter, the car, the money, you know. Half of my relationships, I should have been on them a long time ago, you know. But I stayed in them for selfish reasons. And I didn't get to see that until I actually written inventory through the sex inventory, you know. I know we're out of time, but that's just a brief summary. If you guys got any questions about what we're doing and how to go through the 12-step process, and some of this is new to you, and you're thinking that, well, maybe there's more for you to get here, you know, please come talk to one of us. There's a whole network of us that are doing this now, how we're breaking this down. And the people that go through it, you know, not only are they staying sober, but they're staying happy, you know? So... I want to thank you guys and thank Bill for allowing me to come up here and break this down for you guys.
Glad you mentioned that there are some other people that are familiar with this process. Maybe by a show of hands, if any of you haven't gone through this and you're interested in knowing how to go through this process, we can all maybe raise our hands so you know who is familiar with this.
Some of you guys have been through it. Holden? Rick?
What?
People who have been through the process that we're, the way that we're talking about it, the nuts and bolts, like how we're breaking it down.
So you can ask any of us. If
yeah,
you
have
okay. I'm not there yet.
Yeah, so.
Doesn't this go for another hour and a half?
We have a second speaker.
Yeah. Yeah, but we're going to take a break and Linda's going to come back and tear it up. Later.